plowed my way towards the temple this morning, I had the fugitive thought that if I really succeeded in resurrecting Isaiah, he might thank me for the compliment, but take one look around and say, "But no thanks." Which is by my way of complimenting you for the loyalty of your worship. You know, every generation has its own pet devil. Our own particular demon is the smiling Satan of conformity. How many thunderbolts are hurled against it? As I listen to the punditry of denunciation, which passes as social theory, I am often convinced that America must be nothing more than an endless game of follow the leader. And all of our energies expended with the aimless abandon of a Congo dance line. And yet I must admit that if we judge by the parrot-like chorus which condemns conformity, there must be some truth to the charge. But by and large, I misprize all these disingenuous generalizations. I cannot believe that a society which has reached out to touch the stars and has reached in to finger the secrets of life, a society which has made the greatest advance in education in the history of man, a society which has engineered the greatest diplomatic, democratic experiment in the history of man, that such a society is a group of robots, regimented, without thought, without independence, without strength. I sometimes believe that we mistake the virtue of tolerance for the vice of tractability, and that we misconstrue the blessing of amiability for the curse of unmanliness. Furthermore, I believe in conformity. Judaism insists on conformity. The purpose of life is that each of us should conform to the highest standards and the highest ideals of the human race. What are the Ten Commandments but a curbing of rugged individualism, of nonconformity, of eccentricity? What is the mandate, "Love thy neighbor as thyself," but the statement that we must build a good society? And how can that society be built except as we adjust ourselves, weave a social fabric, conform to the needs of all, to standards of law, of respect, of interdependence, which can be accepted by all? Conformity is in many ways the cement in the mortar of all that we call society. Now, of course, conformity is neither angel nor devil. It all depends on what we conform to. The tragedy of American life, if there is one, is the tragedy of flat and pedestrian disciplines, of conformity to unworthy ends. For there is a vast difference between a shared passion for the paycheck and a shared passion for the service of a profession. Between building a house as a status symbol and building a house as a home. Between study for academic advancement and reading for knowledge and for understanding. Between bemoaning in conversation the plight of the world and throwing ourselves energetically into the adventure and the responsibility of democratic politics. The tragedy of our society is that we often conform to the lowest common denominator. The tragedy is that we weave the social fabric with gray, drab thread, when it ought to be woven with silver and gold. Conformity, the psychological mechanism which permits us to live together, conformity is a necessary virtue among men. Unfortunately, we have misprized conformity, and correspondingly we have overvalued nonconformity. Somehow in American society we have made it a virtue to be bearded and tieless and to wear tennis shoes at all manner of inappropriate occasion. We have mistaken the artistic temperament for artistry, as though Mr. Zell and our Cleveland Orchestra would present more glorious music if they were dressed as a group of beatniks. Among our contemporary poets, Mr. Sandberg, Mr. Frost, did no damage to their poetic muse because they dressed in the normal gray flannel suit, which is so often maligned by our critics. If the manners of an age have dignity, why not exchange them? If the dress of an age is modest and fitting, why not wear it? If the leisure of an age gives pleasure, why not enjoy it? What virtue is there in being a rebel without a cause? What virtue is there of being independent in a world in which you must be interdependent, of cutting all ties when you cannot live except with the ties of love and of family and of society? But the tragedy of this philosophy of nonconformity goes far deeper than the creation of a few bohemian villages here and there in our great cities. For it touches every root value of our society. This glorification of eccentricity, this mistaken notion that idiosyncrasy is equal with independence, has led to a sapping of the vitals of marriage. Why shouldn't I get a divorce? Marriage is nothing but a convention imposed by the society. I have my own life to lead. What responsibility do I have to others? My happiness is all that counts. This philosophy of nonconformity has sapped the vitals of family. It has created an ethos among our adolescents which urges them to march away, to scissor without thought all the ties that bind them to their society. It does not tell them towards what they are marching, and makes them feel that unless they can recreate themselves completely different, other than their parents, they have somehow not established themselves and become adults. And so they march out into the world and trip all over themselves and fall because they are seeking a goal which cannot be achieved. To live apart, other than, when we must live in, with, among. So many of the injustices of our economic order come from this Nietzschean paean which we pay to nonconformity. This is a dog-eat-dog world. I owe no responsibility to another. I will not bethink myself of the hurt that I put on another as I grind his face down for my own advancement. He would not think of me. I will pay my taxes because they are required of me, but no more. I owe nothing. I live to take. I live for myself. Recently, one of our young men came back from college, poured out his heart to me, largely in complaint. He complained because he had been barred from a high holiday worship service, the Hillel on his campus. Why had he been barred? Because he had appeared for the service, tieless, tennis-shoed, unkempt. What kind of business is this, he asked of me. I will fumigate his words a bit. Religion is to energize the individual. You taught me to respect the prophets. What greater nonconformists did you have than these solitary men? These men apart and above. Do you not belie your pulpit? Belie the teachings of your faith? By accepting the ordinary manners and conventions of our society. Well, let's see. What would Isaiah be like, the greatest of our prophets, if we brought him among us at this hour? Well, strangely, he would be wearing the same white shirt, the same neatly knotted tie, the same business suit that you and I are wearing. Isaiah wore all his life the garments worn by his fellow citizens in Jerusalem 8 centuries before the Common Era. He was well-born, well-raised, and well-mannered. He was a middle-class prophet. He had only one marriage. He loved his wife. He was good to his 2 sons. He worried about their report cards. He read the newspaper and complained bitterly about the short-sightedness of the politicians of his age. He paid his taxes and grumbled. In all things, he was an average man. Oh, yes. One day in his later life, all Jerusalem was startled to see Isaiah walking the streets dressed in rags and tatters, much like a slave being led off behind the war chariot of some conqueror. Jerusalem buzzed, but their very comment explains the event. A few months ago, Dr. Spock walked the sidewalks of our city. To what purpose? To emphasize values which he held sacred, values of the Committee for the Sane Nuclear Policy. And he forced us to admit into our minds certain values. He dramatized in his person virtues which he thought were important. So did Isaiah. Israel at the time was considering going to war against Assyria. Counselors were determined to take advantage of some temporary soft spot in the Assyrian hide. And here was Isaiah's way of forcing the people to realize that war could end only in defeat and in slavery. And that if they went to war, they would walk the streets of Jerusalem and out of Jerusalem into exile, much as he was dressed at that moment. But otherwise, except for his convictions, Isaiah was a man whose manners were like yours and mine. Now, we sometimes think of a prophet as set apart by his speech, as being of an ecstatic, of speaking in a trance, of somehow reflecting that which is pathological in psychology rather than that which is normal. Now, again, unfortunately, for our preconceptions, Isaiah wrote out his sermons deliberately. Like any rabbi, he thought for the appropriate word and the correct image. And he erased and he rewrote. He sculpted his words with discipline. He sought the most effective way of reaching out and touching his audience. And if the audience sometimes shivered before his speech, it was not because of the way in which he spoke, not because they sensed something that was almost maniacal in his eye, but because of the brutal frankness, the irrefutable logic with which he spoke. It was the truth contained in his words, and not the manner in which they were spoken, or the method by which they were delivered, which set him apart beyond. What established the uniqueness of Isaiah is that which establishes the uniqueness of any man. His convictions, his commitments, the things which he holds to be significant, vital, the sacrifices he is prepared to make for life. And in Isaiah's case, Isaiah was prepared to dedicate his every vigor, every ounce of his energy to one single purpose: bring about a recreation of the loyalty of Israel, God, to goodness. Isaiah lived in a difficult age, an age not unlike our own, an age in which little Judea, his country, his beloved land, tottered always at the brink of utter catastrophe. During his lifetime, the sister republic of Jews, The larger northern kingdom of Israel was captured by the Assyrians, and the 10 lost tribes were lost, led off into exile, erased from the blackboard of history. And time and again during his lifetime, there was the danger that the much smaller Judean state might similarly be overwhelmed, led off, erased. Judaism might have disappeared off the face of the globe hardly before it had begun its historical pilgrimage. There was danger in Isaiah's day, great danger. And Isaiah was determined that this danger should not overwhelm Judea, that Judea should not trip itself up by untangling alliances, by false political hopes, by such an inner life as saps the vitals of a people. To this he dedicated his life. In this, he gave Israel new life. On what was Isaiah's faith based? It was based on the sanctity of time. It was based on the sanctity of time. To Isaiah, the greatest crime was a frittering away, days and hours, an aimless pursuit. It is to Isaiah that we need that we owe that wonderful description of such men who cry out, "Let us eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die." Isaiah could not understand how men could abide the ordinary selfishnesses of routine in an age of extreme peril and danger. How men could live in their swimming clubs and their country clubs, enjoying their games and their routine leisures and pleasures, and work which was of little profit at a time when the fate of the world hung in a balance. This was beyond Isaiah's understanding. He thundered against the wasting of time. He thundered against the wastage of energy. He thundered that men must discipline their thoughts, discipline their energies, discipline their talents for the single crucial struggle which faced them and faced the nation. Isaiah's faith was born of hope. Early on in his life, Isaiah had an inner experience, a moment of mystical awareness. He had approached the temple, and as he approached the temple, he felt the radiance, the splendor of God reaching out to him and welling up within a response. And that response to the presence of God found with Isaiah certain words, a formula which we all know. We spoke it this morning. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. Beyond the frustrations of the moment, beyond the problems which confront, beyond the manifest danger, there is a world which is majestic and glorious, a God, a world of potential created by God. Man need not feel that his life is too constricted, his world too constrained, that he is incapable and his world inadequate. The danger and defeat must inevitably overwhelm him. This is simply not so. God is good, and God has created goodness both in the world and in man. Now, to have hope, as we Jews well know, is both to be blessed and to be burdened. Hope exalts. It gives spirit. Hope is a great anchor, a weight which drags you down. The pessimist, the man who has no hope, can be very tolerant. Compromise, an inadequacy. He has no great expectation. He is never troubled when men fail to live up to measurements he does not set. But to be burdened with hope is to see etched in every act, in every man, the difference between what he might be, what he is, between what he might achieve and the level of mediocrity in which he lives. This mediocrity, a pedestrian in life, constantly disturbed Isaiah. He had no patience with councils which said, let us teach, let us prepare. Next year, in 10 years perhaps, in a decade, in a generation, this community may be prepared for integration. This school district may be open to children of other races. Isaiah had no patience with such counsel. The time was now, the immediacy was apparent, the urgency was upon the people. So he spoke with words which hit like a hammer against the anvil of social conscience. He labeled as evil those who were evil. Did not rationalize, he did not explain. He simply pilloried. Woe to the land speculator. Woe to the man who seeks only to aggrandize, to swallow up. Woe to the man who calls evil good and good evil, who rationalizes every action. Woe to the man who lies awake at late at night, wenching and whining. Woe to the man who thinks only of himself, who draws iniquity with cords of vanity. Woe to every nonconformist, every selfish man of his day. Sometimes Isaiah was burdened because of his hope with that clarity which has come to us through such novels as Failsafe, a clarity which sees the ultimate ineffectuality of man, man's inability to avoid his inevitable fate. He's called in many books the prophet of doom. Very often there is etched into his words a feeling of the inevitability of Israel's dispersion. He spoke to his people for 40 long years. He found them no better at the end than at the beginning, still sunk in their own inadequacies, still unaware of their own potential. He felt that inevitably this muddling through of the people must fail. God would punish. They would be defeated. But somehow, surging beneath this level of clarity of vision and thought, surging deep within the bowels of Isaiah, within his innermost being, with one of the greatest faiths of hope, statements of hope known to man. It is to Isaiah that we owe that poetry of hope which is familiar to all of us. It shall come to pass in the end of days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and many nations shall go unto it. And people shall come up and say, come ye, and let us go up unto the house of the Lord, to the house of the God of Israel. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he will judge between many peoples, and decide between nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they make war anymore. In Isaiah's personality, we feel that tension we sense within each of ourselves, between a certainty that there is no solution for us or for our society, the arms race, nuclear testing and the like, and the equal certainty, the faith, that somehow man will intervene, interpose his own disciplines, his own duties, his own reverence, his own sense of decency, and men will beat their swords into plowshares and reduce their bombs to power which can be turned to the benefit of man. Burdened with hope, Isaiah had no patience with those who made religion a bartering forum, an agency with which to bribe the deity. We have those who want to bribe God in our own day, who believe that somehow by inscribing God on our coin, by engraving God in the marble above the rostrums of our forum, by establishing national days of prayer and the like, that somehow God's vanity will be titillated, and he will see to it that we are favored as a people above all the other peoples whom he has created. And so it was in Isaiah's day. The more difficult, the more inadequate the politics of the day, the more the court made it a process of coming to the temple and offering the routine sacrifices. And how Isaiah howled forth against such hypocrisy. Hear ye the words of the Lord, ye people of Sodom. Give ear unto the word of God, ye people of Gomorrah. To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices unto me, saith the Lord? I ask not for the blood of rams nor of he-goats. Bring no more vain oblations. They are a sacrifice of abomination unto me. Your new moons, your Sabbath, your holding of convocations, I cannot endure iniquity along with a solemn assembly. Wash you, make you clean. Put away the evil of your doings from before mine eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do well. There is the faith. There is the ideal, the gift which God asks of man. His works, his heart. Not his bodily presence, his distracted mind, his membership fee. Heart, soul. Sacrifice, being, labor. This is the offering which we must make. Burdened by his hope, Isaiah took a dim view of the political machinations of the day. At best, they were counsels of prudence. Worst, stupid folly. Isaiah came close to being a pacifist. He would have believed with those who preach today in unilateral disarmament. For Isaiah believed, there is no victory in war for the conqueror or the conquered. That the only victory in life comes when a nation has established its spiritual foundation, its national integrity. That there's no purpose in defending boundary lines if you are not defending a way of life which is worthy. That Israel had no claim on survival if Israel could not be distinguished from all the other nations on the face of the globe. So Isaiah put no great weight upon the horsemen of Egypt. They are but men. And the chariots of Egypt. They are but wood and iron. Be steadfast with God. Quietness, worship, the worship of the whole being, that is your strength. Isaiah then is a prophet of conformity. Conform yourself to the will of God. Adjust your life to the highest standards of the human race. How he would have lashed out against all those victory firsters in our day. Tell us that we must put into the deep freeze all of our domestic problems until we have solved the political equations of the Cold War. This reversed the very thing Isaiah was trying to say 2,700 years ago. Solve the social issues. Solve your personal problems. Find inner strength. Build the roots of family. Establish the ties of community. Build equal justice and equal opportunity and the larger freedom. God will help you beyond this. But if you live only to protect, if you fear only the enemy from without, If you live your life in a constant exchange of embassies, compromises, conventions, protocols, and the like, you will ultimately fall. You will ultimately be dragged down, for you will lack the enlivening strength which comes from rightness, righteousness. Isaiah preached conformity. Conformity of man to Torah. Conformity of man to the will of God. And it's strange but true that in giving ourselves wholly into the grip of an ideal, giving ourselves wholly into the service of God, we are regimented into independence. We gain very freedom, which we cannot gain by escape, which we cannot gain by eccentricity, which we cannot gain by cutting ourselves off, which we can gain only being at one with God and with man. Amen.